Hello and welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast. Today's topic is human trafficking prevention in light of January having been Human Trafficking Prevention Month. We are pleased to feature a conversation between CalCasa's own Imelda Boonkob with three individuals: Megan Kehoe from Merced Valley Crisis Center in California, Monte Jewell from Rape Counseling Services in Fresno, and Jennifer Botello from Family Services of Tulare County.
This is Jennifer, and even with the existing funding that's out there right now, it's really about response, and while there's education component around there, it's not anything around primary prevention. And so it's more about educating the public about what this is. But if we want to have some real meaningful change, I think we're going to need to do some true primary prevention.
I think by doing public health right, we also do criminal justice right by intervening effectively and early on and offering an escape hatch for a traumatized person. We have an opportunity that others don't to build a rapport that might last through a law enforcement investigation and even through an effective prosecution.
And I like the idea of building it into programs that we're already doing, because we're constantly being asked to do more with less. But there's a way that you can integrate primary sexual assault prevention, and there's a way to build that in, especially if you're doing a community mobilization type of approach, because it all goes hand in hand. Trying to prevent sex trafficking is part of trying to prevent sexual assault. We would be negligent to not consider how do we move forward with this without extra funding to be able to do the work.
Right. And as with any work that we do, funding is always on the top of that list to really help us continue to do the work that we're doing. And even more so, not that it didn't exist before and that Rape Crisis Centers hasn't seen it or encountered it before. Now it seemingly now has a name and it has additional services attached to it. How do we support that? And how do we support the response and the extra work, if you will, around providing assistance to victims of trafficking?
I know that this is a different way of looking at that power and control dynamic we're so familiar with, and the commodification of people that are being moved around the area or even just done locally. One of the interesting things that I think further research needs to be conducted on is how it manifests in the cities, in an urban setting, but also in a rural setting, especially when we're talking about the integration of labor trafficking and sex trafficking in the migrant farm worker population, how individuals are then taken and put into this human trafficking business as victims is so diverse, it's so hard to pick one area and work on it when a new way is popping up every day.
This is Monty, and we bring assets to this problem that others don't. I've seen Megan's agency and Jen's agency collaborate with our office to offer options to folks who are in dire straits. And we have collaborated to create a kind of underground railroad and transport someone to safety. And one piece at a time, we can build safer choices for people who are suffering from that kind of trauma. By communicating with each other, it's not just us reaching there. It's an entire network of safety. I think that funders will be looking at the sort of things that we're able to accomplish through that cooperation and wondering, you know, what ought to be funded.
Well, definitely collaboration and cooperation is important in working this issue. As we know, there are networks of traffickers and exploiters. Well, we as people who respond to it and help prevent it and intervene on trafficking need to create just as a dynamic network against trafficking as well. And I think that's great that you're recognizing that in your area, and that's what's really critical. And across the country, there are collaborative task forces, and whether they're funded or not, understanding that it is a needed response in those communities that are seeing trafficking happening.
Monty came up with the idea, and we've been sending emails back and forth about the Underground Railroad. And I know that that concept is alive and well also in Los Angeles, where they're actually having entire coalitions and fundraisers and calling it the new Underground Railroad. And I think it's an amazing concept, and it embodies it so well because of the idea of that for these types of people who have been trafficked, they're no longer safe where they are, and they have had to move around so often. And moving physically sometimes is the only way to gain that safety. But I also think we need to look at the way these folks are being targeted and address before the process of recruitment, harboring, and moving people happens with the human trafficking process. And looking at the spectrum of prevention, I think we started work in each of these areas, but I think we're barely scratching the surface. This is a market-driven crime. And because the need and the want is there, that is why the commodification of humans is so prevalent these days.
Megan, you mentioned that there were folks in Los Angeles working on that Underground Railroad. The ability for an advocate to offer that option to somebody creates a feeling of safety and a possibility and certainly builds rapport.
Absolutely, and having that Underground Railroad is so important. For example, my experience working at CAS, Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking in Los Angeles, we actually had a partner in Florida where a survivor needed to move out of state. And so they ended up coming to LA and staying at our shelter, but still the case was being adjudicated in that state. And whenever the survivor needed to be talked to within the criminal justice system, they knew who to contact, and the survivor felt safer to engage in the case because physically they felt safe and far away from the trafficker or the trafficking situation. So it truly is an effective approach. And I think a place to start is maybe the task forces, the BJA, Bureau of Justice Assistance task forces that are funded, and to connect with them, because I know that there are a lot of NGOs, and whether they're rape crisis centers or community-based organizations or immigrant-based organizations that are sitting on those task forces that you can connect to and start creating that nationwide network, if you will.
I think it's a great idea, and that's a great success story, Imelda, of how it's done successfully and how the prostitution process and the trauma is minimized of going through that, the prosecution process, because in a normal setting, that person would be in the same courtroom as their trafficker. Mm-hmm. Talk about power and control dynamics right in front of you. So I think that network of being 3,000 miles away from the other person is fantastic, and I think that is the best practice.
And I believe Monty mentioned it, if we're going to have a trauma-informed practice, then this is one way to do that, is to create this network, this system that truly does recognize the various ways that trauma impacts a survivor and how can we alleviate that in the systems that we create in intervention and prevention.
Absolutely, Imelda, because we're trying to gather data. So if we have some of these more effective kinds of interventions, you know, where there's some engagement, you know, there's some meaningful assessment, we actually intervene, something goes on, well, then we can record that data in a way that's going to be more useful to us later when we're trying to evaluate the outcomes and decide, you know, how to try it next time.
What we're finding here is that human trafficking survivors have already been coming through our doors, but they present themselves very differently. They are coming in looking for help with restraining orders against their former partner. They're coming in asking for shelter because they are now homeless, but they don't see themselves as being a victim of human trafficking until we do some of our intake questions that we've now tailored to try to draw out some of the specific dynamics of a trafficked individual. And because we've been doing that, we have had folks working with our advocates who will say, yes, that question I identify that I was asked to perform sexual acts against my will, and this is the circumstances in which that occurred. So how do we as providers try to help them holistically with providing services, or everyone thinking that they possibly could be a victim of human trafficking walking through our doors, but we may not know it until we sit down and have a counseling session. And as a result, we will then change our queries and our data system to reflect that, yes, they are a victim of domestic violence, yes, they wanted help with a restraining order, but this also is related to human trafficking. So trying to make sure that we aren't limiting the services when maybe a victim doesn't even know that they were a victim of human trafficking and that was just a part of everyday survival.
Looking at that evidence helps bring clarity to assets that we have. So we have statutory confidentiality, and sometimes there can be tension between whether you're going to observe confidentiality, particularly for a minor, or there's going to be some encouragement or even, you know, more forceful involvement of law enforcement. Looking at that kind of a question from the perspective of the statute and public health brings a lot of clarity about the value of being able to offer confidentiality, because no one's going to feel safe and no one's going to report if they feel like the next call is to law enforcement. And in situations where there's no imminent risk to the reporter, then rapport building ought to be the most important priority, because that is the thing that's going to prevent harm in the future.
We teach our children that to get help, you go to a police officer, where that then becomes a commodification that turns into criminalization if you're over 18, because a lot of that trauma-informed response hasn't reached that line of work, per se. Where that confidentiality, I think you so wonderfully pointed out, that negates that completely, that criminalization. They're able to reach out for help that may have been limited by the fear, whether it's that their trafficker instilled in them that if they were to reach out for help, they'll go to jail for solicitation. That just makes that issue null and void, providing a much more encompassing mode of communication and a way to reach out for help in a much safer way. And I think we need to really focus on that piece, and it's not in any of the messaging that we are seeing in the media.
The objective is to stop the harm, but we're interested in stopping all of the harm systemically. And I think that means that we're forced to take the legal privilege that we offer victims seriously and to try to get the knowledge that that privilege is available to people when they most need it.
Oftentimes, for example, foreign victims of trafficking who are coming from a country where they can't trust their law enforcement because they themselves, one, are complicit to these kinds of, you know, egregious crimes, and two, are involved in human trafficking, that they come here to the United States and for them to be told that, you know, to trust law enforcement, they're not going to necessarily go straight to law enforcement, but to know that there's a community-based organization that can speak to them in their language or has materials in their language and says, this is a safe and confidential place for you to talk about your experience, whether it's human trafficking, sexual violence, intimate partner violence, then there's more of a likelihood that they'll reach out to that system rather than the criminal justice system.
Well, thank you. And this was a very meaningful opportunity to have all of you talk about human trafficking prevention. So we were joined by Megan Kehoe, Program Director from Merced Valley Crisis Center, Monty Jewell, Executive Director of Rape Counseling Services Fresno, and Jennifer Patello, Program Manager from Family Services at Tulare County Rape Crisis Center. Thank you all for being on today's podcast and for your expertise and for the wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Imelda. Thank you, Monty.
Thanks, Imelda. Thank you, Megan.
Thanks, Monty and Megan.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CALCASA.org.